You're listening to episode 12 of the Social Speech Podcast. I'm Rob Cottingham. This is where we look at how the newest communication technologies are transforming the oldest, public speaking. Over the next few weeks, I'm talking with some of the smartest public speakers, speech writers, communicators, and event professionals I know about how they're dealing with social media, the obstacles and opportunities, and maybe what the future holds. This episode, I'll talk with Mitchell Beer of the Conference Publishers in Ottawa, Canada. I've known Mitchell for years, going back to my political days in Parliament Hill and even a little earlier. So it's a special pleasure to get to talk with him about the work his company does around what you might call conference journalism, bringing a reporter's passion for storytelling to bear on conference communications. As a speaker or speechwriter, that's worth paying attention to. You want your speaker's message to play a prominent part in those communications. It's one of the ways the life of your message can extend past your speech and spread beyond the conference hall. Here's Mitchell. So tell me a little bit about what your company does and who it does it for.
Well, thank you for that, Rob. Our company actually goes by two varieties. We are the Conference Publishers, and we are Smarter Shift. For the last 28 years as the Conference Publishers, we've gone on site at more than 3,000 meetings, events, workshops, congresses in more than 200 communities across North America. We've set foot in 18 countries. And what we like to say is that what we do is capture the content that makes meetings worthwhile. Within meetings and events, quite necessarily, there's a lot of emphasis on the logistics, on the tactics, a lot of thought about, you know, what the menus are going to be and how the decor is going to look. And within its own context, that stuff does matter. But what we try to talk to meeting planners about is people aren't going to remember the floral arrangements or the seat covers when they get home. They're only going to remember the food if it's really bad. But what they'll want to bring home and what their bosses are going to want to know that they picked up and brought home and did something with is the content that they discussed, shared, learned, deliberated while they were in the conference sessions. And it turns out that capturing that material in a text format that is more detailed than a PowerPoint but less detailed than a transcript or less detailed than a verbatim video, that turns out to be the nice middle ground where people can actually do something with the material. Over the last several years, we've become a lot more involved in advising people on the communication and social media strategies that will help them get more impact and more lifespan out of their conference content, and that is where Smarter Shift came from. The idea that for a lot of clients, it makes sense to start out from that cornerstone of communications and social strategy, figure out what elements of an editorial calendar make the most sense given the organization's objectives, its audience, its purpose, what it needs to achieve with the material. And then very often, you know, the content from one or multiple meetings and events and the whole potential behind virtual and hybrid meetings might well be a part of the plan. But at this point, we're trying to approach it from both sides because we think that's the best way to be responsive to what different clients need.
Now, the conferences that I used to go to, the only real artifact you'd take away from them, apart possibly from somebody's sharing a printout of their slides or a very brief handout, it's that newsletter gets slipped under your door in the middle of the night that may have a few pictures of the party the night before, or, here is one quote from a speech that somebody gave. Has that changed? Are you finding that there's more than just that slip of paper that you can give to people?
Well, sad to say, there are some places where it isn't changing, but a lot of places, the good news is a lot of places where it is. We go back in this work far enough that the first conference newsletter we ever produced in the 1980s, so much fun to be able to say that, wowed the client that we could actually produce a back-to-back sheet on 8.5 by 14 paper every morning, and we did it by printing out galleys on a daisy wheel, not a dot matrix printer, on a WordStar, but not WordStar, not WordPerfect software, so that the layout artist could wax the back of those pieces of paper and paste them down on a layout sheet. Thankfully, things have changed. There are still audiences and times and places for print content. And if we really want to be audience-centric, then we should really want to respect and honor that. But the real excitement now is to be able to take that content online, to be able to take it into multiple different formats. It's online text. It's online text supported by photos and video. It's social media platforms. It's mobile. And what that opens up is, first of all, an opportunity to very, very deliberately and one would hope thoughtfully, determine the platforms, the places online, the places out in the electronic world where different target audiences already congregate, find them with the content they want in the format that's most useful to them at the level of detail they most need when and where they need it. That's not something you can do when you're just producing a single print publication.
How do you go about finding out what the audience is going to be interested in and maybe where they're congregating, whether it's online YouTube video or they're more interested in Facebook or they're more on LinkedIn, or whether they're still really interested in getting it in something they can hold in their hands and shove under other people's noses?
Yep. As a service provider, actually that too is you know, one of the reasons that we're trying to diversify our practice to find an entry point into the strategy, because very often if our first step as strictly or primarily a content provider is to ask the client, well, where does your audience congregate? More often than not, we're talking to somebody who has little or no time for the conversation, who's assuming that if we're asking what else they need, that, hey, we're a vendor, we must be looking for more budget, when in fact we're probably thinking of something that's more affordable for them. Or if not, we should be. And so the conversation usually goes, well, this is what we've always done. No one's ever objected to our award-winning on-site daily. Do you think you can meet that standard in print? Whereas if we can get into a strategic conversation, and where this is happening, it's going very well. It's been, you know, very interesting and I think very useful to clients. To be able to take a step back and say, you know, so starting point, why are you doing this? You know, based on your organization's objectives and where you need to be 2, 3, 5 years from now. You know, first of all, why are you holding the conference? And how does the content and how do the outputs from that conference support what you're trying to achieve? Given that, who are you trying to reach? And who are the audiences you may not have thought of who you really, really need to reach? And once you've determined that, questions of format, questions of level of detail, questions of platform, questions of where on the web you look for people. You know, they might be on your own website. It might be that you need to go out and find them where they are. And particularly if there's an audience you're trying to influence, if it's an advocacy situation. You know, there's no point, well, there's some point, but it's not the end of the story, it's just the beginning, talking to your own members or affiliates or stakeholders about what you really need them to talk to somebody else about to make things better for your organization or make things better for the world. You need to find out where the decision makers and the broader group of stakeholders is and find them there. And you might need two different pieces of content for each of those audiences from the same source material. It just depends.
And it strikes me that when you're dealing with, you know, a paper newsletter or whatever artifact you're giving to people, it can be great and people can love it and they can engage with it, but it's much more difficult to get a sense of exactly how they have engaged with it and whether they have than, say, if you're using something digital like a YouTube video or an infographic that gets shared and you're able to tell, okay, we know how many people have seen this and shared it and reposted it, and we have some sense that that's getting take up, whereas this other thing where we're putting effort into, say it's a complete video transcript of something, that's really not getting seen at all, and we can know where to focus our efforts next time.
That's right. We were involved in one, and I like the way you framed the contrast between text and video. This is not to say that there is never a time or place for a full verbatim video of a conference session. But within meetings and events, generally the fallback is to say, oh, sure, what are you talking about? We captured our content. We had a single camera at the back of the room. No, we didn't see the technician yawning. You must be making that up. And I actually did see that once. And we put the video up. It was on the website within about 2 weeks of the conference. We thought that was fantastic compared to the year before. We were involved in a project where there was actually quite excellent video sync to PowerPoint that was provided by a very good vendor in the U.S. there, who we recommend whenever that particular service is needed. We also produced for each one-hour session about a 200 or 300 word news capsule, the level of detail you'd expect in a conference newsletter, and then about a 900 word summary of the event. The production was one thing, but the communication strategy was full credit to the client. They developed, they executed it. By distributing the material, rolling out one news capsule per week for about 10 weeks after the conference, they managed to generate more than 69,000 page views for a conference that originally only drew about 600 or 650 face-to-face and virtual participants. The sequel to that story, and I like doing this as a pop quiz, you know, out of 69,000 page views, and I've just told you that the video provider rocked, you know, they were awesome. What proportion of those 69,000 page views were for video? You know, and the guesses that I get back are anywhere in the range of, you know, 25%, 40%, 90%. Out of 69,000 plus views, 774 were for the verbatim content. More than 67,000 were for the news capsules.
Wow. Well, there's a reason that people watch The Daily Show rather than C-SPAN.
There is. And there are times when people need C-SPAN, and we know to feel badly for them and thank them that they're doing it because it means we don't have to.
So yep. For speakers.
But you know what? There are times when we need C-SPAN. I was meeting with a verbatim video producer about 3 years ago, and they mentioned that one of the surgical associations was one of their clients. And the way I remember it, they might remember it differently. You know, I sort of interrupted the person in mid-sentence and said, okay, fine, I completely get it. That if your audience is a surgical society and the subject matter is a new surgical technique and the participants are practitioners whose next stop is going to be a surgical suite with somebody who until now has been a live patient, please let me be the first to agree that what those participants need is every minute of the full hour demonstration, not the 15% of the words spoken that we could provide. I'm really good with that, whether I know the patient or not.
Well, there are times when detail is tremendously important. Knowing exactly what was said was important. Having access to the complete complex narrative of something is really important. And there are audiences for whom that's important. And there are others for whom a kind of casual, that's a really interesting single insight that I can take away from this, is really what matters.
Exactly. And what that brings us back to it, you said it, is, you know, every audience and every purpose and every set of objectives should either dictate a slightly different content strategy or at least dictate that we think out what our strategy is, rather than assuming that what we've been doing for the last 5 years or five decades is going to work because we think it worked before. So thinking it out might lead us to the same conclusion, but we'll get there a lot better. I guess the one thing that makes me nervous, and you know, I'm you know, kind of reveal myself as a content nerd here, I guess. But what makes me nervous about a world of 300-word news capsules is, again, exactly the thing that you said, that there are times when the complexity matters. There are times when the details make a difference. It can be useful in a lot of cases. I mentioned that for that project with the 69,000 page views, we provided news capsules and summary text, so that readers could decide what level of detail they needed and get access to one or both when and where they needed it. For that particular audience in that particular subject area, the final stats were more than 67,000 views for the news capsules and 1,280 for summary text. The fact that that broke my heart was immaterial. The numbers spoke. There are going to be times and places when the additional detail is needed, and there will be situations where a client would not be well advised to offer a full news capsule as an option when they know the success of what they're trying to achieve depends on people really getting it in more detail than even a Pulitzer Prize writer can convey in 300 words.
So for the people who are creating that content and either delivering speeches or crafting presentations or writing them or participating in panels, what can they do to make the most of this new environment, the back channel, the fact that they have audiences now that are participants as well as passive listeners, to make things as easy for you to distill into news capsules or other formats as possible? How can they make the most of this?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, a couple of things come immediately to mind. One is that to be able to make good use of the back channel, it's important, I think, for speakers to get used to doing that and get comfortable with doing that. The back channel that a lot of people love to hate on site, of course, is Twitter. You know, whether it's Twitter with a big screen up front with the Twitter comments scrolling over the speaker's shoulder.
And I'm just going to interrupt for a second because this has come up again and again. So I want to know the on-screen Twitter back channel. Would you describe yourself as pro or con?
I'm pro.
Oh, really? Okay. Interesting.
With conditions.
Yep.
With conditions. Okay. Pro, first of all. You know, at the risk of getting tedious here, pro as long as it suits the objectives of the event. You know, it's easy to imagine events where that would be counterproductive or distracting, or audiences where it would be distracting. But I think it does contribute. Pro as long as the organization has, first of all, has somebody monitoring the feed with a light hand, so that they're not just arbitrarily censoring, but so that if something comes up that is inaccurate or is problematic, the organization's ready and set up to respond. And what we've learned is useful, and this was something that we, I think, did for the first time anywhere ever about 2 years ago. And at first we were trying to figure out, okay, so it's the world's first. The question is, does this really matter? I think on balance it probably matters somewhat. Occasionally, we will assign writers to cover conference sessions, and all they do is live tweet it. But if the if the hashtag for the conference is #ABC2012, we'll go out there as #ABC2012 space news. We'll take up the extra four characters in the space. We will start tweeting about a couple of hours and a half hour before, saying, coming soon to this session, ABC 12 News, all the news and just the news as it happens. And we'll be tweeting right into the standard stream. Organizations can do it themselves as well if they have the in-house capacity. Somebody tweets into the stream, and the difference is that it's all just news reporting. The way we like to describe it is that in a one-hour session, we might generate 60 or 80 tweets and express a whole range of opinions, but none of those opinions belong to us. It's all attributed content, which means, that if, your keynote speaker is up on the stage and somebody begins tweeting, he's just an idiot. Alongside that, what people following the stream are getting is the very good or the very bad substantive content that person is presenting, and it means people who aren't in the room can make their own judgment. So, what that goes back to is, yes, very much for using Twitter, first of all, to engage virtual audiences and keep them engaged. Secondly, to open up a channel that is much more participatory and lends towards much more active engagement on the part of participants, whether they're face-to-face or virtual. And I think that's, a solution or part of a solution to what's been a really critical problem for meetings and events for a long time. As long as it's done right, and as long as some forethought goes into, how this will work within the context, the culture, the objectives, the needs of the organization. Really quickly, another, I think, useful tip for speakers. At the moment, I'm tuning out on exactly what the time span is. I think it's 7 or 8 minutes, 12 minutes, something in that very small range. There's a documented time after which you can expect people to tune out. Mm-hmm. and actually, I think what it is that I've heard different estimates, ranging from about 8 to 12 to 15 minutes, after which you can expect audiences to tune out. They might come back, they might not, but they'll tune out. So whatever you're presenting during that time is lost. And once again, back to what we were saying before about some topics just being more complex than that, there are things you're not going to be able to present from a podium in 15 minutes and get the whole story. But the way to deal with that is to present in 8 or 10 minute blocks, break the session up with something, you know, a table exercise, a Q&A, a video, anything that breaks the flow from a talking head at a podium. I think a lot of speakers either feel that that stops them, particularly motivational speakers feel that stops them from being the center of the universe, so it can't possibly be right. More substantive speakers feel that they're selling people short if they use half their time up with videos and interaction, but it makes for a much better presentation and a much better session that people get a lot more out of, and the speaker gets a lot more out of as well, because they're learning from the 30 or 50 or 33,000 people in the room.
You know, that kind of gets to the distinction that Kathy Sierra made so classically a few years ago between marketing or organizational communications that says, look at us and how much we rock, and says more, the kind that says more, look at how much you are going to rock with this. And yep. I think a speaker who is all about, look at me, I'm a fantastic performer, for a very few speakers, that actually works because they really are and they're fantastic. But others are going to find their greatest power and the greatest impact by showing the folks in the audience their personal skills, their abilities, the wisdom that they may not know that they had. And ultimately, that actually may make more of a difference in people's lives. You may have more of an impact as a speaker by engaging your audience and having your audience take something and run with it.
For sure, for sure. I mean, I think it's incumbent on speakers to bring something of substance to the podium. You know, if it is just fluff, if it is just nonsense, if it is just flavor of the month stuff, don't bother. You know, life's too short. No one has time. No one wants. I mean, maybe people do want to hear it, but in my pretty dogmatic view, they shouldn't. But that said, you can bring substance by droning on for 2 hours, or you can bring substance by being a much more engaged and engaging and interactive speaker. And I think, you know, door number two in that framing is a lot more fair and a lot more effective, more useful.
So usually we do one tip and one tool, and you've given several tips, I think, for speakers.
Okay.
I will ask you in a second for one more tip for a speaker who's maybe hoping to get into that kind of news capsule summary. But is there a tool, first of all, that you'd suspect or that you'd suggest to speakers and folks who are presenting it or at conferences that they may have overlooked or that you're seeing as being underused?
Well, I think a general category of tools, you know, whether for speakers, whether for organizations that hire speakers, is just the whole area of analytics. I think this is one of many areas where the tools are shifting and changing. You know, so that recommending a specific one now might be a different story 5 minutes from now. But as a general comment, I don't think there is as much analysis and measurement of results going on as there is talk about how we ought to, or you all ought to, measure results. So I think finding an analytics tool that works, verifying that it works, and then really following the evidence that it gives you would be my only slightly evasive answer to that question.
Well, and something that gives you numbers that aren't just numbers for their own sake, but something that's actually actionable. It gets to the kind of outcome that you wanted to see.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. You know, what I've been hearing in a few places, and I'm glad people are saying it, is, you know, if you're going to ask the question, have some idea of what you're going to do with the answer. You know, recognizing that the answer is going to shape how you respond or why bother asking, but, you know, understand why you need to know this, or don't bother with that survey question.
So something beyond just, ooh, my clout score went up by one.
Yes, exactly. So that means exactly what? In meetings and events, there's a lot of conversation about smile sheets or happy sheets that ask deep and probing questions about whether the coffee was hot enough and the room was cold enough. and then the seats were comfy enough, but not so comfy that, more than about 10% of you fall asleep, but nothing about whether the speaker aligned with why the participant was in the room, and most important, why. You know, a speaker might get a 95% rating, and that's glorious, but if you don't know what it was that delivered that for this particular audience, you haven't learned very much.
I would love to see a conference evaluation that you get 6 months afterwards that says, are you doing anything differently as a result of having attended?
Well, isn't that an interesting point? Because there are meetings ROI mechanisms, meetings ROI frameworks. One in particular that talks about five steps, and I can't remember whether the post-survey 3 to 6 months after is, I can't remember whether that's level 3 or level 4 of the 5, I think it's level 3 of the 5 levels. You know, and they say right out, I mean, you may not have the time, the resources, the need to do this for every single conference, you know, but please go to a higher ROI level for at least some of your measurement. And I don't have a really clear fix on how often it happens. My understanding, and I could well be wrong on this, is that it doesn't happen very often because, first of all, budgets are so tight that meeting planners, meeting organizers are not doing anything that they don't see as absolutely mission critical. And I would argue that this is, but it's not always seen that way. And secondly, because resources are thin, the moment an event is over, it's done. They're through with it. There's no follow-up afterwards. And so 3 to 6 months from now, I may have done 3 major events since that one. So why would I look back? When, in fact, that's exactly the right time to look back.
And would you have a tip for speakers who are hoping to do what you do for conferences, where you're extending the life of the conference beyond the gavel to gavel and turning it into more of a conversation, to how they might do that with their presentations and the content that they're sharing with people?
I think the opportunity is to think about the different platforms and media that are available for extending the life of that content. Think beyond verbatim platforms, depending on the audience and depending on the different organizations that a speaker is trying to reach out to for you know, future business, future contact. There might be any number of different text formats that will help deliver the message. There are any number of different online, sort of web or mobile locations where the different audiences you're looking for gather. And the other key, I think, goes back to something you said earlier, Robin, that is it's about them, it's not about you. In other terms, it's about pull marketing, not push marketing. And rather than trying to continually push your message and your brand out there, frankly, you know, whether you're a speaker, whether you're a conference, whether you're an association, whether you're a widget producer, more and more the story that works, because it's a story that's more useful and more genuine, is here's something that's of interest to you as an audience, and if you want more, sign here and you know, sort of sign up to this website, sign up to this newsletter. You'll keep getting more of this, and it's not a sales pitch. We're just trying to build an online community and build a relationship and be confident that the sales will come in time.
Mitchell, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yes, my pleasure, Rob. Thanks very much.
Now over to you. If you know a great tool or tip for using social networks and shared media in public speaking, if you have a cautionary tale, or if you have some thoughts about where all of this is headed, let me know. Share it with me on the show notes. Just visit socialsignal.com/social-speech and look for the podcast link. Or email me, rob@socialsignal.com. The music for this podcast is Cold Cloth and an Ice Pack by the wonderful late Derek Miller. You can find this song and many others under a Creative Commons license at penmachine.com. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.